Session number 10420, rule 29.
Colonel W.I. Watson, Reel 29. You're now on your way back from Esquikerrit.
Yes.
What happened next, Colonel?
And I think I mentioned that we got to Habeneyar. And I went into the officer's mess and there saw the fixtures of the Royal Exodus Hunt. And they'd had a lawn meet Saturday before we arrived, and to think that the hounds were still there when war was at the doorstep. Now, we had been warned that we would possibly be raided by the Iraqis for rifles. But we'd been warned by the Prevost and the area commander, I think it was, or the camp commandant, something like that. All the Bren guns were in boxes, and they were dug in the tents, and the chaps slept on them. And they slept with their rifles attached to their wrists at the end of the sling. One end of the sling was taken off the rifle and put round the chap's wrist, and he rolled up in his blanket with his rifle. And the officers had to sleep with their revolver cords round the necks and the revolver tucked in to their blankets and pajamas. And we had four sentries outside each company. One was patrolling, two were patrolling, one was on the stores and one was on the cookhouse. This is just the company. And one man had to sit up all night in the tent awake, and we had a fire burning outside until midnight. And we had a light on in an oil lamp or something like that in the tent. I suppose about midnight, there was suddenly a shout and some rifle fire in the camp. And what had happened was that one of these sitting up sentries in the tent had spotted a nasty, horrible face at ground level under the tent flap, looking in at the tent and attempting to pull out a rifle. I think, too, elsewhere, a chap woke up and felt his rifle being pulled out from his blankets. But what the Iraqis did, very slowly, they touched the sleeping soldier on the shoulder and made him turn round over, and then they were able to pull the rifle out. And they were either cut off, the sling was cut off, and was cut, and the rifle drawn out, and all that the soldier had was a bit of sling on his wrist, or in some cases, I think the sling was undone from his wrist. I fear some chaps didn't really have the rifle attached to his wrist. He just slept with it in his blanket. Anyhow, five were stolen. And the CO was nearly demented because it was such a black mark. But we weren't the only ones. I think the 9th, the 8th, and the Cheshire Regiment, and our machine gunners, they'd all had rifles stolen. And, of course, what happened was as soon as they were stolen, the thieves just dropped over the embankment or the cud or the cliff down and were out of view and out of sight.
Were men charged for losing them?
Yes. There was a court of inquiry. I see, I'm not sure that they weren't all court-martialed, but I can't remember now, but there was certainly a court of inquiry later. And it all came out what had happened. But it was just through one sentry seeing a nasty face looking in under the tent flap, for which he was sitting there, just to see. And the next night, we were travelling back now the same way, more or less the same way as we'd come. Next night, they tried it again at one of the staging camps along the desert, but they were seen before they had any, were able to do it, one or two Iraqis. But it was a bit of a blob, but there it was. The CO, as I say, was almost demented. But it was a fearful stain on the regiment if it had been on the northwest frontier in India in the old days. And the Iraqis were probably better than any of the chaps in the inhabitants of the northwest frontier. Anyhow, we travelled on, and when we got somewhere about Rutba Wells, or we went through Ramadi, Rutba Wells, and stops as much the same stops as we'd done before, we were told our destination was to be the Western Desert, and we weren't going to Libya, weren't going to Syria and Lebanon. And our advance party came back and joined us en route. It was very interesting to see what progress had been made as soon as we got into Jordan by the Royal Engineers building a decent road. We'd been travelling across the desert in that sort of arrowhead formation. And we could do 20 miles an hour on the sand of the desert quite easily, even more if we so desired. But all the bridges one noticed as one was travelling across the desert, across the Transjordan on the new road, all had the sapper badge on, RE 1940. And I suppose to this day they're still there with the sapper badge, because it was the sappers who were making the road. And our final night in Transjordan was 30 yards, from the Hejaz Railway, the famous railway smashed up by Lawrence of Arabia. In fact, I think there was a train, an engine still lying on the railway that Lawrence had blown up. And then on the 15th of February, we went down into Palestine. And it was a superb sight, because it was all spring. The whole countryside had a veneer of green over it. And you could see in the distance the mountains of Gilead, and you could see Mount Tabor. And I remember as we came down, wound down the curling road down to the Jordan, the flowers were beautiful. There were those Brigid anemones and all sorts of other flowers flowering, and pimpernels. And I heard an old warrior say, in my company say, "Lads, fill your bellies with this sight, because it may be many, many months before you see another one like it." And that was as we wound our way down to the river Jordan. Well, we settled into a camp across the other side of the Jordan, in a wood of eucalyptus trees. Now, if you fell eucalyptus trees, the stool growth grows very quickly, and you soon get a coppice of eucalyptus. And we, I remember, we stopped, spent the night there, some 5 miles south of Nazareth. Well, we were, in fact, in Samaria. And the next day, we left for Tulkarm to entrain for Egypt. Well, Tulkarm's very prominent today in the West Bank, and always having trouble there. And we camped for a while near the station, in a sort of small transit camp. I got a very good shower there, I remember, and we were, the men were allowed into the town. And in the evening, we entrained in one carriage for the officers and 31 12-tonner trucks for the chaps, for the men. And we traveled across the Sinai Desert, to the Suez Canal, at Kantara. We had to get out at Kantara, and of course be ferried across the canal, because there was no bridge across in those days, and then entrain again, and eventually we arrived at Railhead in the Western Desert, some 5 miles from Bertolata. And we were there rationed to 3/4 of a gallon of water per day. Then we were about 25 miles, I think, from Sidi Barani. And there was a great deal of German activity because they did, in fact, I think, hit the train that had brought us all this way with a New Zealand crew, and I think they wounded both the engine driver and the fireman. But by way of an introduction, it blew the most appalling sandstorm, and there was a transit camp there, so-called transit camp, but they never expected us. So we just marched out into the desert, scrounged as many tins and buckets or tins as we could find, petrol tins, and made little tiny shelters with stones and rocks to shelter from this appalling sandstorm. And it was bitterly cold. I remember the chaps, we were all in battle dress, of course. I remember my chaps wearing their greatcoats, and we had to spend a couple of days there, I think, and there was much German air activity at the time. However, it would be about the 22nd of February, we moved to El Adam, 8 miles south of Tobruk, and we had an 83 miles desert journey past Conference Cairn and Bir Shefersen, and then the next day, about the 25th, as we got nearer to Akroma, there were more signs of war. But nevertheless, as I always did, I looked for birds' nests, and I found a desert wheatear and a desert lark's nest. And another thing, where there were little tiny saucers in the desert sand where rain would have accumulated, and these desert saucers were full of the most beautiful flowers, a mignonette, wild mignonette, and evening-scented stock. And they provided nesting places for cream-colored coursers and little bustards and things like that, birds like that. Nevertheless, there were very, very definite signs of war. And we moved forward in penny packets. We didn't move forward in one long convoy so that the Germans wouldn't see whole battalion moving up en masse. And I remember one night we came there in the evening, it was a pleasant evening. I was sitting next to talking to Sergeant Bailey, one of my Teasdale regulars who came from Barnacastle, and he was a great fisherman. And he said, well, how nice it would be just to be down on the river with one's rod. And then on the 27th of February, we moved into the Gazala line with much activity.
Can you describe the desert terrain?
Yes. Well, now, I'll read, if I may, the description of the desert that is in Nicholas Bird's of Egypt, which I think is a splendid description. The desert is like as fickle as any woman. It is when she is boisterous that one hates her most. She never assumes familiarity, never permits a liberty, gives freely of her charms, which never fail to please. She takes and gives of her best, cruel and merciless to those who play with her. To ignore her is to court disaster. Her favors and follies are various and numerous, her surprises never failing. One cannot linger or loiter in her arms. She demands efficiency and energy, characters which she respects and repays. To lassitude and carelessness, she meets out death in a hideous form. And that's true. I mean, many people in the happy days of Cairo would, on a weekend, go out deep into the desert and camp, just because it was attractive and they took care. But if they didn't take care, then she meets out death in a hideous form. Now, much, much later on, after I'd finished commanding the battalion, I was down on the Suez Canal, on the Gulf of Suez, below Suez, and there were two young officers set off to go to the Egyptian post way, way down the Gulf of Suez. And what they should have done, of course, was to tell the people down there at the oil wells on the Egyptian post that they were coming. But they failed to do that. And of course, they broke down. And that was the end of them. And I remember that happening because I was down in that part of Egypt at the time. So you had to be careful. And if we drove out into the desert, we always went in pairs in case one truck broke down. Almost the very first day, I drove out into no man's land. I'll describe the Gazala line later, but I drove out into no man's land with Parkinson, my splendid driver, and some Italian planes came over and hit a truck of mines. These engineers or somebody were laying some mines out in our front and hit a truck and it exploded with a most fearful bang. And Parkinson and I nipped under our own 1500 weight tractors, that's all I used to use in those days. And when we crawled out again, Parkinson said to me, I wonder what our mothers would be thinking about us doing now. But that was early on.
What is the desert terrain like? Sand?
Sand, and it's not the patches. Of course, if you went south into the deep Sahara, you'd get sand if you were much further south than where we were. But places quite a hard surface which you could drive happily along, and in other places you got this white sort of rock sticking out, and it became very rocky, but it was barren apart from this, the coastal strip. Once you got further south, and it became completely barren. There was nothing growing except perhaps a bit of camel scrub here and there, but you got these lovely plants growing in these little sources as the result of the rain. But then as soon as the rain stopped, the heat came and shriveled everything up.
Did you have to discover things for yourself, or were there anyone?
Nobody. You discovered it all for yourself. We went into the Ghazala line and we relieved the battalion of Rajputana Rifles, which, strange to say, wore a black badge, really like us, with a red background. They would obviously were pretty tired and weary, and you could see that. And they were, of course, all Indian troops, and we took over. Now, their positions, which we improved, as I'll mention in the next reel, but all the slit trenches and the positions were absolutely flat. They had no parapet and no parados. You know what I mean? Nothing in front and nothing behind. They were as level with the desert, so that you were more or less invisible until the enemy would stumble upon you. But we had a lot of work to do when we took over. But I think really the best thing to do is to describe our stay in the Ghazala line from the, what was it, the 17th of February until we came out in June.
Before we talk about the Ghazala line there, Colonel, you did mention the fact that you were in a sandstorm just at the railhead. What exactly was a sandstorm like?
I tell you what a sandstorm was like, because we suffered them when we got into the Ghazala line. You saw an enormous wall of sand coming slowly towards you. I mean, it was a tremendous height into the sky, this wall of sand, and it came slowly towards you. You felt very lackadaisical, and you realized that the Germans too would be feeling the same with this wall, and it gradually came slowly towards you, and the sun went out, and you were enveloped in nothing but a mass of sand in the air. The whole atmosphere was thick sand, and it blew slowly past you going eastwards. And it was really quite an awe-inspiring sight. But after it had passed, then you knew the rain would come, and everything would be nice and cool, and the sand would have disappeared. But it was a tremendous wall. And unless you'd seen one, you'd never appreciate it. Right up into the sky was this solid wall of sand coming slowly towards you.
And basically you could do nothing while it was on.
Nothing. You felt absolutely rotten. And another thing too, which what we experienced, was static electricity. If you touched the bonnet of your car during one of those sandstorms, or when there was a lot of sand blowing about, you would get a shock. And today you see cars with chains hanging down behind them. Well, the ammunition trucks and water trucks always had those chains hanging down behind them in the desert.
How did you get from the railhead to the Ghazala?
In MT, 3 tunnels, in lorries, we were taken. and we went right up to our positions in the Gazala line.
And did you drive straight into the positions, or
just outside the box, probably. I can't remember quite, but we were just outside the box, and we walked through the gap in the minefield into our positions, which were shown to us. We took over from the Rajputana rifles.
Was the changeover made at night or during the day?
No, during the day.
Was the Germans were quite some distance away from
you? Yes, I'll come to that later. Yes, they were a very long way away.
I believe you said that previously on the tape that you were dug in to the level of the to the level of the ground.
Really. Yes, yes. There was nowhere where there was there a parapet or a parados. All the positions were ground level, so you could almost walk on top of them before you knew you were there.
And was it easy ground to dig into?
Not particularly, but we had sappers and they could blow holes, and it didn't interfere, as it did in the Alamein line, didn't draw the attention of the enemy, because they were so far away.
And were the positions linked in some way? Were there tunnels or communication?
No. They were just close to each other. So you'd have to walk from one to another.